allow us to turn in our Bibles to Paul's first letter to the Corinthians and chapter 13. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians in chapter 13. On the 29th of July 1981, a worldwide audience of 750 million people were glued to their television screens for... What was that occasion? The wedding of Prince Charles and Lady Diana. If some of you can remember that far back. It is vivid in my memory because it was a day after I was baptized. And amongst the many things they heard that day, those 750 million people, was a scripture reading from 1 Corinthians 13. Just over 16 years later, on the 6th of September 1997, a worldwide audience of 2.5 billion people watched the funeral of Princess Diana. And in doing so, they heard Tony Blair, the then Prime Minister of Great Britain, read 1 Corinthians 13. Two occasions in the life of one person that led to billions of people here in 1 Corinthians 13. And if you add to that the countless number of times over the centuries that this chapter has been read in weddings and in funerals, and I'm sure you've been there and you've heard it, you cannot help but come to the conclusion that this is one of the best known passages in the whole of the Bible. But what is perhaps not so well known are the circumstances that led to the writing of these words and the context in which they were originally heard. You see, the first time these words were read out in public was not at a wedding. It was not at a funeral, but it was at a gathering of a local church, just like this. And far from producing comforting thoughts or romantic feelings, as they have done on many occasions since then, the first hearers of these words would have hung their head in shame. And I say that because these words were originally written as a stinging rebuke. If you look back to chapter 12, you'll see that it's a chapter on spiritual gifts. If you look forward to chapter 14, and you'll see that that too is a chapter on spiritual gifts. And so you may be thinking to yourself, why? Why does this sweet and soothing description of love, why does it fall between two chapters on spiritual gifts? As Von Robert says in his little book on 1 Corinthians, he says, at first sight it may look out of place, as if Paul has misfiled one of his wedding sermons between two chapters on spiritual gifts. But in fact, says Von, it is carefully written to communicate just what he needs to say at this stage of his argument, and it forms a bridge between chapters 12 and 14, end of quote. As we worked our way through the first 12 chapters of this letter last year, we discovered that Corinth was a church which had a lot of problems and a lot of faults. If you're sometimes tempted to think that there was nothing wrong with the Philippian church, then you might be tempted to think that there was nothing right about the Corinthian church. And from what Paul says in chapters 12 and 14, it appears that one of their weaknesses was their wrong attitude to certain spiritual gifts and their incorrect use of those gifts. And the fact that this 13th chapter is sandwiched between the other two chapters would suggest that their faults and their failings on spiritual gifts stem from a distinct lack of, or at the very least, a serious misunderstanding of true Christian love. And so it is to that subject that Paul turns in chapter 13, and as he does so, we learn several things. The first being in verses 1 to 3, and there we see the necessity of love. The necessity of love. Now, having listed various spiritual gifts at the close of chapter 12, Paul says in verse 31 of that chapter, "But eagerly desire the greater gifts." And if you're desperate this morning to find out what those gifts are that are greater, then I'm sorry to disappoint you, because you need to wait until chapter 14 to find out what Paul meant there, because in the meantime, he's going to show us something else. And that is, end of chapter 12, the very last sentence of chapter 12, "I'm going to show you," says Paul, "the most excellent way." In other words, he's going to speak about something that is more excellent and more important than even the greatest of the gifts, and that is love. And if you want to know just how important Paul considers love to be, then listen to what he says in verse 1. "If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal." Now, when we get to chapter 14, I will try, which should be next week, God willing, I will try and explain what first century tongue speaking seems to have consisted of. But what I will say for the time being is that just because Paul refers here to the tongues of men and of angels, that does not mean that there were times when tongue speaking consisted of human languages and there were other times when it consisted of angelic languages. To make his point in verses 1 to 3, Paul is using a certain amount of hyperbole. He's using exaggerated hypothetical scenarios. And so rather than just say, "If I speak in the tongues of languages of men," which is what first century tongue speaking was, he adds the extreme hypothetical scenario of even being able to speak not only in the tongues of men, but even being able to speak in the tongues of angels. Likewise, in verse 2, he speaks about being able to fathom not a few mysteries and not even some mysteries, but all mysteries and all knowledge. Nobody, of course, regardless of what their gift they possess, nobody could do that. Nobody. But that is the extreme hypothetical scenario that Paul describes in order to make his point. Likewise, when it comes to faith, he refers not to an average faith and not even a remarkable faith, but a faith that can even move mountains. When it comes to generosity, it's not a generosity that gives half of what I possess to the poor, however great that would be. No, it's a generosity that gives all I possess to the poor. And when it comes to suffering and self-sacrifice, it's not imprisonment or even a beating that he quotes, both of which Paul would later experience. Instead, it's the very extreme of self-sacrifice, surrendering my body to the flames. Do you see what Paul is doing in verses 1 to 3? He's describing a number of scenarios that go way beyond the experience of any Christian, and certainly beyond the experience of any Christian in Corinth. He's describing a number of extreme hypothetical scenarios in order to make his point, and his point is this: even if he were able to do those sort of things, but did so without love, then it would all amount to nothing. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. Now, from what we're told in chapter 14, it appears that the Corinthian Christians have elevated tongue speaking to be the greatest of the gifts and the pinnacle of Christian experience. As far as some and perhaps many within the church were concerned, tongue speaking was the mark of real or deep spirituality. But, says Paul, without love. Without love, even that is of no greater significance than the resounding gong or the clanging cymbal, and his choice of sounds and instruments probably refers to the noises that were heard in the pagan temples of Corinth. As we discovered in chapter 8, Corinth had no shortage of pagan and idolatrous venues. And in such places, it was common practice for the worshippers to, and if you had gone to Bangkok with Wynne this morning, then you would have heard this. In such places, the worshippers will bang a gong or clang a cymbal to drive away demons and to arouse the attention of their gods. As far as true biblical Christianity is concerned, such sounds are, of course, meaningless. Meaningless noises that accomplish nothing. And therefore the banging and the clanging of the pagans is a complete waste of time. And says Paul, if it's done without love, what we Christians consider to be our greatest spiritual abilities and what we view as being the greatest expression of our spirituality, if it's done without love, then that too amounts to nothing. It too is an empty, meaningless waste of time. That is the necessity of love. And it was a necessity regardless of whether their particular gift was tongues or prophecy or faith or generosity or even martyrdom. And many years later, that love is no less a necessity in our Christian lives today, in our Christian service today, and in our life as a local church today. You see, what these verses demonstrate, and it's frightening, what these verses demonstrate is that it's possible to exercise remarkable gifts in the Christian life and in the life of the Christian church, but to do so for the wrong reasons and with the wrong motives. Back in chapter 12, verse 7, Paul has emphasized that to each one the manifestation of the Spirit is given for the common good, i.e. for the good of everyone in the church. That's why spiritual gifts are given. For the good of others, for the good of everyone. But you know as well as I do how easy it is for the use of our gifts to degenerate into a selfish, self-centered display that is first and foremost not for everybody's good, but for my benefit. The temptation to use our God-given abilities for the massaging of our egos or the enhancing of our status, that is not a temptation that is exclusive to the musical or sporting icons of our secular society. That is a temptation that we face as Christian people. That is a temptation that we encounter in the life of the Christian church. And believe me, the more public or prominent our role in the life of the church is, the greater that temptation becomes. For reasons I will explain next week, tongue speaking is not the most prominent of gifts in the life of this church. But that does not mean that 1 Corinthians 13 is no longer a challenge to us. Whatever our God-given abilities are, and whatever our role in the life of the church may be, we must always examine ourselves to see whether we are fulfilling that role and exercising those gifts out of love, out of love for God and out of love for others? Or is it all done out of love for myself? If it's the latter, then no matter how impressive, no matter how remarkable, no matter how super spiritual it may appear, it's a waste of time, says Paul, and it amounts to nothing in the sight of God. Because as one writer says, the chief mark of spirituality is not certain abilities, but love. That is the necessity of love. Secondly, verses 4 to 7, and there we see the character of love. Now, having emphasised the necessity of true Christian love, Paul goes on to describe what such love looks like in practice, and he does so in both negative and positive terms. Negatively, verse 4, it does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it is not rude, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered, it keeps no record of wrongs, it does not delight in evil. But instead, positively, verse 6, it rejoices with the truth. Love is patient, verse 4. Love is kind. It always protects, verse 7. Always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. The reason I said earlier that the original recipients of these words would have hung their heads in shame as they heard this chapter being read out in public was because their attitude and their behaviour on many occasions was the exact opposite of what's described in these verses. And we've seen that as we worked our way through the first 12 chapters. I'll just briefly run through a couple of examples. For example, whereas love is patient, they hadn't the patience to wait for one another as they ate and drank together as a church, chapter 11, verse 21. Whereas love does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, they were continually boasting about their favourite leaders, chapter 4, verse 6. They were boasting about their knowledge, chapter 8, verse 1, and it is highly likely that they were boasting about their spiritual gifts, chapter 12 and 14. Whereas love keeps no record of wrongs, some within the Corinthian church were taking their fellow believer to court, chapter 6, verse 1. Whereas love does not delight in evil, some within the church appear to have been happily engaging in sexual immorality, chapter 6, verse 15. Whereas love is not self-seeking, or as the ESV says, it does not insist on its own ways, some of them, as we discovered in chapter 8, some of them insisted on exercising their rights and their freedoms on matters of conscience, regardless what others in the church felt or thought about such things. They insisted on exercising their rights. The definition of love in verses 4 to 7 is the exact opposite of their actions and attitudes on many occasions. And so rather than fill them with romantic thoughts or feelings as it may have done for you at a wedding, this definition of love would have made the original hearers of these verses feel extremely uncomfortable as they realized just how far short they had fallen. Whereas they were measuring spirituality in terms of their gifts, their abilities, their experiences, Paul is reminding them in this chapter that love is the real measure of spirituality. And when he says love, he doesn't mean some vague, mystical, undefinable concept of love. No, he means love of the type described in verses 4 to 7. Because that is the character of true Christian love. As you know, we live in a world and we belong to a generation that is on about love all the time, all the time. It is the theme of endless number of songs. It is the theme of endless number of soap operas. And when you compare our society this morning with the description of love that is given in verses 4 to 7, you quickly realise that our society knows very little of true, authentic love. Very little. That's the conclusion we come to when we look at our world. They know very little of true, authentic love. The question is, what conclusion does the world come to when it looks at us? And yes, they may well be looking. Because as Jesus said in John 13, verse 35, by this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. And the reason, says Jesus in the previous verse, why we ought to be a people who truly and genuinely love one another is because it is we of all people who have experienced a true and a genuine love. We sang about it earlier in the service, did we not? Here is love. If someone in the world came to you and asked, where can I find true love? Where would you point them to? Here is love, vast as the ocean, loving kindness as the flood, when the Prince of Life, our ransom, shed for us his precious blood. If you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, then can I encourage you to consider the love that God has shown to sinful, rebellious people like you and me in sending his son not only to the manger at Bethlehem but sending him all the way to the cross where he died and suffered in the place of sinners like you and me. Here is love. And says Jesus, as I have loved you, listen to this for a challenge. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. And if you want to know what that love ought to look like in practice, then just read Paul's description of it in 1 Corinthians 13. But as people look on, and according to Jesus' words, they may well be looking on. As people look on, is that what they see in us as a church? If an independent observer, someone from a consultancy company, was to come and was to spend 6, 12, 18 months amongst us and then went away to write up a report, what would his impressions of us be as a church? What would we be known for as a church? What would you want to be known for as a church? Would we be primarily known for our doctrinal orthodoxy? Would we be primarily known for our gifts? Would we be primarily known for our evangelistic zeal? Would we be primarily known for our exceptional commitment? How far through the report would you need to read to hear that we are a people who love one another? And love one another in the way that is described in verses 4 to 7. Love one another with a love that is patient with each other in spite of enormous differences in culture. Love one another with a love that is kind in spite of differences in class and character. Love one another with a love that always trusts in that rather than being continually cynical or suspicious of one another, we seek to believe the best about one another. love one another with a love that always perseveres, or as the ESV says, endures all things, in that it does not give up on people or write them off. Is that the kind of love that we are characterized by and therefore known for as a church? And in response you may say, but David, all churches are different. Churches have different emphasis from one another. Some church major on one thing, another church majors another thing. I know that. I know that not two churches are alike. I know that churches major on different things and have their different emphases. But let me just say that the point that Paul is making is that if we are not characterized by love, then what we are majoring on, or like to think we are majoring on, what we are majoring on might not just prove to be a minor, it might prove to be nothing at all. If it's not characterized by love, then there is the very real danger that the orthodoxy and the gifts and the zeal that I mentioned earlier, things which in and of themselves are essential and desirable and commendable, but if we are not characterized by love as described here in 1 Corinthians 13, then it may be that, like the Corinthians, our apparent strengths may count for very little, very little. Because what you have described here is the character of true Christian love. And don't forget, that is the measure of true Christian spirituality. Moving on, verses 8 to 13, and there we see the permanence of love. The permanence of love. Now, as you probably know, Christians come to different conclusions on the subject of spiritual gifts. There are, and I'll just very briefly and simply explain the two polar opposites, if you like. There are continuationists who believe that all the gifts mentioned in the New Testament are for today and for use today, and then there are cessationists who believe that certain gifts have ceased and are therefore not for today. And what is interesting is that both parties have often pointed to the closing verses of chapter 13 in order to prove their position. For example, cessationists have highlighted verse 8, where Paul says that there will come a time when gifts of prophecy and tongues of knowledge will cease, and in order to defend their argument, they have taken the reference in verse 10 to perfection coming as a reference to the completion of the canon of Holy Scripture. Continuationists, on the other hand, have said that the perfection of verses 10 to 12 is referring to the second coming of Christ, and therefore we should expect all these gifts to continue until then. Now, next week, I will seek to explain why we as a church come to a cessationist position on this subject, but what I will say this week is that personally, I'm not sure 1 Corinthians 13 is the place to go to in defence of either argument. And the reason I say that is because this chapter was not written to provide us with a timetable for either the continuation or the cessation of certain spiritual gifts. And that is why, in my assessment, that is why both sides of the debate end up with what I would call unnatural interpretations of these verses. For example, the traditional cessationist interpretation of perfection in verses 10 to 12 is, I would say, a little bit unnatural. And the most obvious reading of those verses seems to be the future return of Jesus Christ. Now, that is not to say that the cessationist position is therefore wrong, because don't forget, Paul is writing halfway through the first century, and like most, if not all, first century Christians, he lived and wrote and taught as if the return of Jesus Christ was imminent, and therefore could easily happen while the scriptures were still being compiled. And so, taking the perfection of verses 10 to 12 to mean the future return of Jesus Christ does not disprove the cessationist position, and neither does it prove the continuationist position either. And the reason I say that is because when we get to verse 13, we hear Paul saying this, "And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love." Paul is describing certain things that will outlive the gifts of prophecy, tongues, and knowledge. And those are faith, hope, and love. But if all the spiritual gifts continue up to the second coming, then what era is Paul looking forward to in verse 13, where the gifts of tongues, prophecy, and knowledge will have ceased, but faith, hope, and love remain? What era is that? He cannot be looking forward to eternity, because there will be no need for faith and hope in eternity. The moment Jesus Christ returns, faith will give place to sight, and the Christian's hope will be fully realized. As Paul says in Romans 8, verse 21, "Hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what he already has?" But the one thing that will remain into eternity and will continue throughout all eternity is love. And that is why, even amongst faith, hope, and love, the greatest, says Paul in verse 13, is love. It is by far the greatest because of its enduring and its abiding and its permanent relevance. And that is the point of these verses. Now, can I just say, if you want to hear more on spiritual gifts, come back next Sunday morning. But can I just say that if we go away this morning thinking about nothing other than spiritual gifts and forget all about love, then we really have failed to see the wood for the trees. And so, as I pointed out, it seems to me that both sides of the discussion run into problems when they base their arguments on 1 Corinthians 13. And in one sense, that shouldn't surprise us. Because, as I've already said, the chapter wasn't written to answer that question. Instead, it was written to highlight and emphasize the importance of love. However much energy and emphasis the Corinthians put on their spiritual gifts, what they need to remember is that such things are temporal, such things are passing, such things are partial, and at very best, such things are imperfect, verses 8 and 9. That was true of their spiritual gifts back in the first century times, and it is true of our spiritual gifts today. Whatever gifts we may think they have, they are temporal, they are passing, they are partial, and at very best, they are imperfect. Whereas on that future day, when perfection comes, verse 10, the partial and the passing and the imperfect will all disappear. The contrast between the now and then, verse 11, is like the contrast between childhood and adulthood. You remember what it was like growing up as a child. There were certain things you did, there were certain things you enjoyed, you were fascinated by some things, and then you got into adulthood, and as you look back, you think, boy, why did I really like that so much? What was so good about that? I've got into adulthood, and therefore I've put those things behind me. That is the contrast, says Paul, between the now and then. It's like the contrast between childhood and adulthood. It's like the contrast between looking at a poor reflection in a mirror, verse 12, and on that day, seeing face to face seeing your Lord face to face. Now we know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. What a great era to look forward to. And don't forget, the one thing that will remain into that era and throughout that era is love. And so, that being the case, why put so much emphasis on things, and why invest so much time in things that are passing and temporary? Isn't it better to make the one thing that is lasting our absolute priority as Christian people and our absolute priority as a Christian church? And that one thing is love. Of all the things we may wish to characterize us as a church, isn't it much better to be characterized by the one thing that will characterize us throughout all eternity as the people of God? And that is love. Of all the things we may wish to be known for as a church, isn't it better to be known for the one thing that will single us out as disciples of Jesus Christ in the present, and the one thing that will single us out as the people of God throughout all eternity? And that is love. As Paul says at the beginning of verse 8, love never fails. As the ESV says, love never ends. Everything else will end, but love never ends. These three remain: faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love, for the simple reason that love will outlast them all. That is the enduring and the permanent relevance, significance of love. And so says Paul, in your life as a Christian, and in your life as a Christian church, make sure you've got your priorities right, and make sure you're prioritizing the one thing that is a mark of true spirituality, the one thing that will convince a world that we really are followers of Jesus Christ, and the one thing that will characterize us throughout all eternity. Make sure you are prioritizing love. Three things we learn about true Christian love from 1 Corinthians 13. Firstly, the necessity of love. Secondly, the character of love. And thirdly, the permanence of love.